Welcome to the first episode of Religion and American Life, a podcast of the Boisy Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. I am Mark Massa, the director of the Boisy Center, and today's podcast host. This podcast is the newest initiative in the Boisy Center's commitment to connecting a community of scholars, policymakers, media, and religious leaders in conversation and scholarly reflection around issues at the intersection of religion and American public life. Today we are joined by the former editor of Christianity Today, Mark Galley, to discuss his life in the Evangelical Church and as editor of Christianity Today and his life since. Mark was baptized a Catholic. His mother, who had stopped attending church, had a born-again experience when Mark was 13 years old after hearing Billy Graham on television. After her conversion, Mark's family attended a conservative evangelical church at which Mark also had a conversion experience. After UC Santa Cruz, he attended Fuller Theological Seminary and was ordained as a Presbyterian minister. Eventually, and along the way, and maybe Mark will want to talk about this, he discovered the Book of Common Prayer, the wonderful Anglican and Episcopal prayer book. And liking the divine office, Mark and his family joined St. Mark's Episcopal Church near Chicago. At the same time, he began working as an associated editor with Christian History, a journal affiliated with Christianity Today. Mark then became an Anglican and just recently has been received into the Roman Catholic Church. From 2013 until January 2020, Mark was arguably one of the most visible editors in the evangelical world in the United States as editor-in-chief of Christianity Today. One of his final acts as editor-in-chief was his now famous editorial in which he called for the resignation of President Donald Trump, one of the things we'll be talking about today. Mark Galley, welcome.
Good to be with you. It's an honor to be on this, your first podcast.
Thank you. We're delighted to have you and joining conversation with you. Mark, if you could just...
You can
just
only go up from here.
tell me a statement that is true in so many ways. Mark, tell me what it was like being the editor of Christianity Today, which was, of course, a revered Protestant journal started by people like Billy Graham and others decades ago, and is arguably one of the most read journals of Protestant opinion in the United States. What was it like being an editor-in-chief there, and how did you conceive your readership? Like, who made up the readership of Christianity Today?
Well, the one thing I noticed immediately when I became... First, I became managing editor, and then I did that for about 10 years, and then I was editor-in-chief. I had been editing, like you noted, the magazine Christian History. And, you know, we'd put out issues on Catholics, Protestants, revivalists, women in the early church, all sorts of topics. Even some people who were heroes in some parts of our world, but whose actual lives were less than admirable, like John Knox, the famous Scottish Presbyterian. He was an angry man. Well, we'd publish these issues, and nobody would say anything because I think they read the magazine and said, well, that's history. What can you do about it? But everything we did in Christianity Today, inside the office and out, was politicized in some way. Not politicized in the sense of partisan politics, but there were constituencies and interest groups and passionate people on one side or another, and it was just sort of a place you had to learn how to negotiate what you said, when you said it, how you said it. And so that's that. And because it is, like you noted, probably in many respects, the premier evangelical magazine in the world, if certainly in the United States. And I pretty quickly understood that the audience for Christianity Today was not your typical evangelical, especially as the news media understands an evangelical. I learned early on that when they did a survey of readers back in the 70s or 80s, I joined it in the 90s. So the information wasn't that old. It was some astounding number of Christianity Today readers had college degrees, and many of those had had masters or doctorates. You know, in the United States, what's it, 20 to 30% end up with a bachelor's degree? What was
That's correct.
Easily yeah. double that. And so I knew we were dealing with a very kind of niche group of evangelicals. And the more I edited it, the more I realized that, especially when the a whole group of evangelicals from the right found themselves enamored with Donald Trump. It became clear that me and our staff and all of our readers would look at those evangelicals and say, who are these people? And that was my first inkling that inclination that there was a deep divide in evangelicalism and that Christianity Today, I knew we didn't represent all the evangelicals, but we were in a lot of ways out of step with mainstream evangelicals as understood on the street, on the ground. But we did appeal to what I'd say would be called evangelical leaders. So that's Good. How we understood our kind of our mission.
So would you describe your readership at Christianity Today vis-a-vis the mainstream evangelical set of believers, would your sense in terms of the responses to editorials and articles that the majority were Trump supporters or the majority were divided, or how would you typify their political stance?
For the Christianity Today readers, I'd say most were, they wouldn't be for Trump. If they were for Trump, they were the type of evangelical who felt caught between a rock and a hard place, and they didn't really, they understood Trump's character failings and personality failings, but they might have felt compelled, boxed in. They weren't going to vote for Hillary Clinton. So, but I'd say most were not enthusiastic about Trump in the least, So, yeah. So in that regard, we were, I couldn't put a percentage on it, but I'm pretty sure that, I'm trying to get a handle on numbers. So let me give you some numbers. I'm guessing that the vast majority of the readers of Christianity Today were very supportive of my Trump editorial. And here's why, the emails that I received were probably 90% yay for the editorial and 10% negative. It was a little different in terms of the snail mail that I got. It was about 50-50. I'm not quite sure why that was true. That probably represented an older readership. And then when it came to subscriptions, we lost 3,000 subscriptions the first week after the editorial, but we gained 9,000.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
So that suggests to me that the people who read CT or who are familiar enough to know what it is, to when they read the editorial, they were willing to subscribe. That suggests to me that most of them were probably not in favor of Donald Trump for president.
So in terms of the political support of the readers of Christianity Today, was among Catholic supporters of Trump, all the polls that I've read show that abortion seems to be the overriding issue that led them to support Trump rather than Biden. Would the same be true for CT readers?
For CT readers, that could be. And why I say it could be, here's my qualification. When it comes to the leadership of evangelicalism, whether it's left or right, ideological issues do play a major factor in how they vote, whether they're for abortion or immigration, religious freedom, whatever the issue happens to be that they're championing. But on the ground, evangelicals, when asked, for example, in October 2016, what was the most important election issue that they were concerned about, the vast majority said the economy. And only 4% said abortion, which means to say that,
interesting.
It's the economy, stupid, as the phrase goes.
Right.
And I just wonder if even when evangelicals who are ideological and let's say they're pro-life, I can't help but think that economics plays a major role in their decision-making. And for better or worse, or right or wrong, evangelicals have in general believed that the Republicans have better policies to help economic flourishing than do Democrats, and they tend to vote Republican. They have voted Republican for decades.
Right.
by 67 to 75%. In that regard, it wasn't unusual that they voted for Trump. 81%, a little high, but for a Republican, not high at all for them. Not that high.
As you know well, I mean, back in the 80s, a group of Catholics and Protestants headed by Richard John Neuhaus and a number of Protestant leaders formed a famous group, an alliance group called Evangelicals and Catholics Together, that was a very successful religious/political alliance pushing forward certain cultural political agendas. Would you say that that alliance between evangelicals and Catholics that took place decades ago in Evangelicals and Catholics Together, is that to some extent the same kind of political stance that CT was addressing? What I don't know, and maybe you don't know, is how many Catholics read Christianity Today. I'm not sure those statistics are even available.
Not very many. Very, very small number. 1% maybe. I mean, we could hardly get Anglicans to read us, let alone Catholics. So maybe Anglicans might have been 3% of our readership. Very small. And in terms of Catholics and Evangelicals Together, it is interesting that two of the main people in that conversation, Tom Oden and J.I. Packer, were both editorial advisors for Christianity Today. So Christianity Today was very sympathetic to those conversations. And whenever a new paper came out, you know, we made room in the magazine to publish it. But it was only on theological issues that, mostly theological, sometimes moral, kind of social moral issues, we might weigh in on and affirm it. But it was we were most interested in the theological dimension of that conversation.
So when the editorial staff that you headed met to talk about what the next issue was going to do, it sounds like that theology really was the name of the game. That the articles you were looking for addressed specific theological issues and concerns that seemed to be the bread and butter of your readership. Would you say that's true?
Yes, definitely. I mean, we would talk about ethics and morals, but we're always grounded in theology and biblical theology. We rarely touched on politics as such. Part of the reason was because of our mission, which had always been to apply the kind of the insights of the Bible and theology to our world. But also because we understood our readership to be politically diverse, and if they wanted intelligent political opinions, there were lots of places they could get those. But there weren't many, you know, they were coming to us because they wanted kind of theological and ethical input from a biblical perspective. And that's what we offered. And that's one reason the art of the editorial, I think, took off. We knew it was going to be controversial in our world, and so we expected. You know, on a typical day at Christianity Today, we might have 300 to 500 people on our site at any given moment. And during a controversial piece, we might get 4,000 or 5,000 people on our website at any given moment. And that's all we were expecting, because we rarely step into politics, and that was a more political. Actually, a careful reader would see that it's first and foremost a moral and theological argument. It's not a political argument, but it'll be perceived as political. That's fine. And so we knew it'd get some of that. But when we had like 17,000 people come on the site all at once and crash the website, it was obviously, it was beyond our wildest imaginations. But one of the reasons it caught the imagination of the American public was because it was political. It was perceived as political. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, everybody.
And it was unusual for Christianity Today weigh in on something that was perceived as political.
I remember the morning that the editorial that you wrote in Christianity Today came out. I had gotten a text message saying, go on CT's website right now. It was from a Catholic journalistic friend of mine. So I went on and read your editorial, and I thought, holy moly, this is like a really important moment. So tell me about the events or issues that led you to decide to write that editorial and what you thought was going to happen as a result of it.
I had just told a Religious News Service reporter who asked me what I was going to say about the impeachment trial hearings, and I told him I wasn't going to say anything because I couldn't think of anything theological or moral or ethical from a kind of biblical perspective that I wanted to say, but I got to thinking about how Christianity Today had handled the previous two impeachment hearings with Nixon and with Clinton. And as I did a little research, I realized that we had made commentary on each one. And I thought, man, it's going to look like we are asleep at the switch if we don't do something. So I was still mostly on, I was mostly decided, but I just checked with my editorial director when I walked in the office on Thursday morning and said, you think we should write something on the impeachment hearings? He says, yes, we should. So I said, okay. So it was obviously something that was stirring within me for some time because I had about 45 minutes before my next meeting. And then I had a couple meetings after that. And I just put down on paper or on a screen things that most concerned me at the moment. It was mostly an editorial directed at the far right of our evangelical movement who had, in my mind, had sold their souls to Donald Trump. Not they weren't just supporters of him, but they were devotees of something that was very close to idolatry in my mind. And that was kind of the energy behind the editorial. Donald Trump's character, or lack thereof, unfitness for office, that was, in a sense, the background to the more direct point I was trying to make to my evangelicals on the far right, who I thought had lost their way in the wilderness of politics. But of course, it was doing both things, and it was perceived in some ways properly as a political editorial and with making a political judgment. But a careful reader will see I was making a moral evaluation of the president. I even refused to say how he should be removed, whether he should be voted out or impeached or what. You know, I didn't have any opinion about that. I just wanted to make clear to those readers on the far right that this was a man of very questionable character, and we had no business as a movement ignoring that. I wasn't even writing to the evangelicals who felt caught between a rock and a hard place and recognized his moral failings, and at least said they were moral failings. I was mostly writing to the people who were completely blind to it and actually defended his moral failings as moral goods, which, as you know, is one of the most heinous things, moral things a person can do, to call something evil good. So that was kind of the energy behind it. My editor edited it. My editorial director edited it. I showed it to the president of our company because I knew it would be controversial. He actually made some additions to make it a little stronger. All of us knew, as I said, it would be controversial in our world. We had no idea it would go viral, of course.
So you weren't expecting the response that you received then. I mean, you were expecting some response, but not the large sort of oceanic response you received.
No way. In fact, I was in the middle of a podcast that afternoon, and I got a call from the Washington Post, a friend of mine who works there, who used to work at CT, in fact, Sarah Pulliam. She's a fine, fine reporter. She phoned me and started asking me, and I couldn't answer, but as soon as the podcast was over, I phoned her and said, what do you need, Sarah? She wanted to start talking about the editorial, and I thought she was phoning as a friend. And after three or four questions in, I said, this is on the record, isn't it? She goes, you bet.
So that's a question I normally make at the very beginning of a exactly. conversation.
But
rather than in the middle of learning some sad,
she was a,
sad experience.
Yeah, she was a friend. And so anyway, and then getting an email from Emma Green of the Atlantic Monthly a few minutes after that, I'm thinking, and then getting invitations from CNN and NPR within an hour, I felt I'd stepped into something, yeah.
So you'd stepped on a live wire for sure. So the response on your website was immediate, or did it grow in the days afterwards?
It was pretty immediate. I don't think it really exploded till the next day when all our servers went down. And I made myself the enemy of our IT people who a month
That's
later-
That's a position that I've been in as well. So my heart goes out to you. So it's like-
Who when I left 2 weeks later, they were still simmeringly angry at me for not warning them ahead of time of what was going to happen. And I tried to tell them, I had no idea this was going to happen.
Right. But you said a lot of the response was very positive and supportive of the position you had taken.
Yes. So a lot of the traffic was just plain interest, like you. Christianity Today wrote on this, said this. Wow.
Right.
So everyone wanted to read it. And then, yeah, there was a lot of anger. Yeah, we had 3,000 canceled subscriptions within the day, probably. But then over the next, you know, few days and a week, we had 9,000 people subscribe.
Wow.
I mean, the one man who I was on his show kind of a week or two later. He had a podcast. He's from Southern California. A proud atheist.
Boston, said, Boston has a lot of those. Don't worry. So
he described himself as a proud and stubborn atheist, but he said, I was so impressed with that editorial. I signed up for a 3-year subscription. So I'm sure there were people like that.
So when did you start to get the sense that the editorial, despite the support, it sounds like a large amount of support for your position. When did you start to get the sense that perhaps the editorial was going to become a big problem for CT?
Somewhere in the first few days or the day or so, it became clear to me that one thing I had done, I had completely alienated our major donor base. Our major donor base would be older, much more conservative politically, and they had been groomed by our development officer into believing that CT was really more or less a positive magazine about the positive things Christians were doing in the world, and that we weren't negative in that regard, and we certainly weren't political. And she was kind of new on the development world in our world, and so I think she overplayed her hand in that regard. And so when this editorial came out, those donors were not pleased in the least. The other group that was really upset was our board of directors, who again had a lot of contacts with these major donors and felt that the editorial was too strong, too one-sided, and it immediately created huge problems for our president. He was only on board about 9 months, 8 months, and now here I handed him this huge PR problem, not just PR, but board problem. And the board was, I had 3 or 4 people on the board who wrote very affirming letters, but I didn't hear from some people. One board member threatened to quit. And it was a big problem internally in terms of that. In terms of the staff, I'd say most people on staff were supportive, but the board and some major donors, it was a problem. Yep. And I felt badly for my president because, you know, I don't want to make anybody's job harder than it has to be.
Right. So, and did those board members contact you directly, or was this indirect? Did you find out about their discomfort?
No board. Well, we have a policy that no board member is to contact the editor-in-chief.
Right. And so when did people on your staff start to talk about maybe this was going to be a problem for you as editor-in-chief?
Well, in one respect, it wasn't a problem for me as editor-in-chief. And that the reason why is I had already announced my retirement on January, in October, I had already announced my retirement that would be effective January 3rd. I'd already had my retirement party. I do think it would have been a problem for me to stay on staff. So I don't want to deny that. But everyone recognized, even if it was a problem, Callie's going to be gone in a couple of weeks, so let's just hang on. I think the sign that it was a trouble was this. I published something called the Callie Report, which is a weekly newsletter, which comes out on Fridays. And we had agreed during my retirement negotiations that the company would continue that because they made a small amount of change from that, and we were going to split the revenue on it. So it helped me with my retirement. It would help them with some of their income. And I represented a voice in our world that they said it'd be good for you to keep, speaking out. That'd be great. So we initially made a 6-month, a 6-month contract that I would continue to do that, split the revenues. Well, within a month of my retirement, our publisher phoned me and said, Mark, we're going to have to cut you loose. We can't, your name is just too radioactive. And it's making it very difficult for our president to raise money, to talk to the board. And so in a sense, I think it was either providential or just fortunate that I was retiring when I did, because it would have created some real awkward moments for him and me.
And so let's say you hadn't announced that you were going to retire in January. what would have happened if you were just sort of sitting there expecting a couple more years as editor?
I think one thing would have happened that I don't know that I would have countenanced. It's hard to say. You know, one imagines in one's mind one's going to be the heroic, draw the line in the sand person. But it became immediately apparent that one of the things the board wanted to do was to see ahead of time any major editorials. And in terms of my understanding of our journalistic responsibility as Christianity Today, that was a no-no. That was absolutely not going to happen under my watch. The president, yes, the president should see everything that goes out before it goes out. He should tell people in our world, especially on the board. Let's say we had the president of Gordon College on our board, and let's say the editorial or some news story touched on Gordon College. He needs to know about that. He needs to tell the president that an article is coming out on that. That's all perfectly fair. But to actually see copy ahead of time, wow, that would have been crossing a line. And I think that's where they wanted to go. I think that's where, I'm not quite sure if that's where they wanted to go now, but I'm sure that was definitely part of the conversation soon after I left. And that's a big problem in my view. And so you'd have to check with Christianity Today to see if in fact that is their policy now. But I know that was part of the conversation afterward, and that would have been a very difficult and awkward conversation.
Yeah, I think an awkward conversation for any journalist with integrity. So I completely understand what you're saying. So that all happened. You were retiring anyways. You stepped down. You left CT. You left the editorial offices. Had you been thinking about returning to Catholicism before that event happened, or was that simply sort of oiled to attract that it was already laid down? Or what's the relationship of that event to your decision to be received into the Catholic Church?
Yes, there was no relationship absolutely whatsoever. As there was no relationship between my writing that editorial and knowing I was going to retire in 2 weeks. You have to understand the type of person I am. That is, when I sit down to write something, I write what I think needs to be said at that moment. And the best way possible, as ironic as possible, but as forceful as possible, and just let the chips fall where they may. So it wasn't like, I'm going to write this on my step as I would step out the door. That thought never occurred to me. It just never occurred to me. And my becoming Catholic, in fact, I was hoping to become confirmed in January, right after I retired, because as you could tell from that statement, I'd been thinking about this and praying about it for years. But there was no relationship to that editorial or my work at Christianity Today. It was kind of a parallel track. I felt, to use spiritual language that is very real to me, I felt that I was called by God to be at Christianity Today and to do what I needed to do there. What exactly that was, what God was going to do with it, it's not, you know, it's not my business. That's His business. But I felt a deep sense of call to be there. But in the previous 2 or 3 years, I'd also understood that this was, evangelicalism was not my kind of spiritual home, and that there was some depth, some gravity, some thickness, some richness to the Catholic tradition that I had become increasingly attracted to over the previous decade, if not more.
Did the people around you at the magazine know what was happening, or did you talk about that discernment process that you had been going through for quite a while with the people you were working with?
No, not really. I realized it would, you know, it's one of those things that would cause more problems than it would solve. And I didn't have anybody at CT that I was particularly close to that I could share this with. I just knew it would be an awkward conversation. When I finally made the decision emotionally and mentally that I was going to become a Catholic, so that would have been about the summer of 2019. No, it would have been earlier than that. It would have been winter 2019 or 2018. Anyway, I did have a conversation with our president and told him what I was planning to do when I retired, just so he had a heads up. And I told our entire executive staff as well. And I told one or two people in the office who I work closely with. But other than that, no, that was kind of it was a parallel track in my life. And some people have questioned my ethics, and I'm the first person to question my ethics. So this might have been a dishonest thing for me to do. But when you're an editor at Christianity Today, you sign a statement of faith saying, this is what we believe as a magazine. Here are the cardinal tenets of what our faith is. And I sign that every year, happily. I could agree with everything 100% except for the phrase about the Bible being the only authority and matters of faith and practice. Obviously, since I was thinking along Catholic lines, I had other sources of authority. But I understood my role as editor-in-chief not to insist on my views being promulgated in the magazine,
right,
but that I abide by that statement of faith, and that I print, publish articles and editorials that abide by that statement of faith. And I argue that when I have to argue a point from the statement of faith, I argued as best as I can from an evangelical point of view. I never tried to be dishonest. I never tried to say, this is what I, if there was a matter in which I disagreed. So for example, there might be something in which I personally didn't agree with it, but I thought what the magazine stood for traditionally needed to be defended. I would say, this is what CT has stood for years, or this is what evangelicals believe. And I would argue it as best I could. I never found an issue that was so, in a sense, wrongheaded that I felt I was betraying my conscience to have to defend it. Because the fact of the matter is, evangelicalism is a stunningly important movement in the United States and in the world. And for all its flaws, does so much good in the world. I could happily champion it as a movement and support it. And still do. I kind of consider myself an evangelical Catholic in that regard.
And there are quite a few people in that camp. So you're by no means alone.
Yeah, no, I realize that. Yeah.
And so at that point, you were an Anglican, and you were very much in, sort of attracted to and enriched by the Anglican liturgy. Was the role of the Anglican tradition, which is a rich liturgical and spiritual tradition, how important was that in your journey?
It was pretty significant. That is to say, as an evangelical, you're encouraged to talk to God as a friend, an intimate. And so you're supposed to use extemporaneous language when you speak with him, in prayer especially. But I found, years before, that I just kind of ran out of words to say that weren't... I was addressing the almighty and magnificent, glorious God of the universe, and I was using such paltry language to address him. And it wasn't even expressing what the deepest things going on inside of me. And there was something wrong with that. Something wrong with depending one's whole spiritual life on extemporaneous language. And that's when I discovered the Book of Common Prayer and found these beautiful prayers, the prayers of confession, the prayer of thanksgiving. And I could say them every day and feel like I'd said something brand new and fresh because they were so full and rich and powerful. And that's when I discovered that the kind of the beauty and wonder of liturgy is that its very repetition is its strength. I mean, many Protestants criticize it because it's repetitive. What I think they fail to see is that its very repetitiveness is its glory.
Right.
Because it instills itself in you at layers you can't even begin to describe. And the words just come, many masses or worship services, you say the words without thinking about them. But I happen to believe, even when you say them without thinking about them, they're doing something to you.
Right, right. Cardinal Newman, when he was received into the church, after he had been a Catholic and a cardinal for a while, he was asked what he missed about the Church of England. He said, I really missed the Cranmer Collects in the Book of Common Prayer, which are some of the best written prayers in the English language.
Richard Newhouse quotes a friend who was asked what he missed about being a Catholic, and he said, the thing I missed the most is the English language. Because he had been an Anglican and loved those prayers. And I will have to admit, the Catholic prayers are useful, but they're prosaic in comparison to the Book of Common Prayer.
They're very prosaic. And I say that the Vatican committee that put those together was called Vox Clara. And I always refer to it as the Vox Obscura group. You know, so it's like they're obscuring my relationship with the Holy One.
Exactly.
So I completely understand. So it's like, So you've described yourself several times as being a Burkean conservative. Could you unpack that a little bit?
Well, actually, that's something that's undergone a shift in my mind. And what I mean by that, again, I'm not well-read. I'm not a political junkie. What I understood by Burkeanism is a couple things. What Chesterton called the democracy of the dead, that is to say, a basic conservative outlook that... we have to respect what people have done, what our mothers and fathers in the faith have done before us. Before we make any significant change, we have to understand why the change was made in the first place, what they were trying to protect. So it's a fairly conservative view toward change without being against change. And then it's also puts its emphasis on the little platoons of life, the family, the town, the church, the village, maybe the county. that this is where the center of political and social activity ought to take place rather than on the kind of the national and centralized politics that you'll find in socialism and other forms of political activity. And now that's changed in this, well, it's undergoing some questioning, and that is probably one reason I've appreciated the little platoons is because, like most Americans, I'm somewhat independent. I don't like other people, especially big governments, big businesses, big anything telling me what to do. But what it's obvious in the coronavirus is we absolutely need some large centralized authority to solve some of our problems. And the one of the reasons the coronavirus is so unmanageable right now is that Mr. Trump's policies says let the states decide what they need to do. And many states are saying let the county decide what to do. And you can't possibly address a pandemic that way. And yet I used to actually have some, you know, favorable, some sympathies with libertarianism, many sections of libertarianism for that reason. Just this notion that we should protect people's right to think and do what they want to do when they want to do it and how they want to do it. But I don't know. I've seen so many libertarians advocate simply stupid ideas when it comes to the coronavirus that I've just lost all respect for that movement. So maybe I'm a Burkean who's a Burkean socialist. I don't know what I am, but yeah, that's what I meant by it, and that's where I am kind of right now politically.
I actually read Burke. Burke was pretty significant in my reading as an undergraduate. So I always describe myself as a chastened liberal, sort of a liberal still, but a liberal who's sort of like has some questions about how the direction of liberalism and progressivism in our time. So sort of, yeah. You know.
That probably would happen to me I think it was the 80s, I started to make a shift. I'd actually, did some neighborhood work for Walter Mondale back in the day, and I had a McGovern sticker back when I was in college. So chastened liberal would describe me as well, yes.
So let me ask you this, Mark. So we're still recording, but what is there something you want to talk about that I haven't asked you yet?
Well, I suppose, I don't know how many people are interested in what attracts a person like me to the Catholic faith. And of course, that's in one sense, it's a complex topic. In another sense, it's mysterious. One doesn't really know why one does some things. But I would have to say one of the-
Well, let me ask you that then. Let me put that on the record and then you can answer. So okay. I realize that people are- attracted to and join religious traditions for a whole panoply of reasons, some of which they are conscious of and many of which they're not or they're unconscious of. What attracted you to Catholicism as a faith?
Yeah, that's, as I've often said, it conversion is a very, the more I've thought about it, it's a more mysterious thing than I imagine. I mean, I can think of kind of some formal reasons I've become a Catholic, but I also know there's some psychological reasons that I'll probably be exploring for many decades. I'm writing a book on that very topic, and I showed a first draft to a friend who said, you should skip all that psychological and story stuff and just talk about your theological convictions. And I told her, I can't do that because it wasn't theology that actually drove me to the Catholic Church. Theology was important, but it wasn't really what drove me. And I think what push comes to shove, what drove me is what I'd call the Catholicism of the Catholic Church. That is to say, I just find it deeply moving that every day is begun with the about today and the daily office is about some saint. And that every service that I go to, the morning mass I go to, ends with a prayer to St. Michael and then the Virgin Mary. And that there's a saint day almost every day. And that during baptisms and other special occasions, there's a long litany of saints that are noted and prayed, asked for prayers. This combined with some experiences I had, like going to a papal audience in Rome when Pope John Paul II was Pope, and I gathered in that St. Peter's Square with maybe 10,000 other pilgrims from Portugal and Germany and Paraguay and Mexico and United States, and each group singing praise songs as they were waiting for the Pope to show up, and in the St. Peter's Square surrounded by those saints above those columns. And then the Pope coming in. And there's a very notion that this church is a huge thing. All the company of heaven, all the saints that have gone before us, and all the people around us, all the diversity of the Catholic Church, liberal and conservative and rich and poor and priests and lay people and sinners and saints. And it's just a mishmash of Catholicism, slower case C, a universal, all around, centered around one, in a sense, one figure, the Pope, one institution, the Church. And when you come out of the evangelical world and the Protestant world, it has now, depending on who's counting, anywhere from 20 to 30,000 denominations, and you can't get them to agree on hardly anything. Not that you can get Catholics to agree on everything, but at least they have to tip the cap to the Church's doctrine and to the Church's hierarchy, even if they want to argue with it.
Right. Yeah.
So that was probably really important to me, was that that sense of Catholicism and you know, it was one holy Catholic Church that was really attractive to me.
And I think I know exactly what you're talking about, and I resonate deeply with that. Is, you know, I'm a Jesuit, and they say, well, if you ask six Jesuits a question, you'll come out with seven opinions. And I think that's typical of the Catholic position. You know, as James Joyce famously said, Catholicism means here comes everybody. And that's a truism. It's become hackneyed. But it's also true, you know, that when I've been in international situations outside of the United States, even though if the Mass is being celebrated in a language I'm not familiar with, I know what's going on.
Yeah.
It's the same ritual.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
So do you miss the colics in the Book of Common Prayer?
Somewhat, although my wife has remained Anglican. She's a very faithful member of her church. And so we tend to say the colics before our meal time. So I still get a chance to read those.
Wow. That's great. That's wonderful. Wonderful. It's been a privilege speaking with you, Mark. I'm delighted that we could open all of our podcasts with a conversation with you. I wish you blessing on your work, especially, I think, besides our conversation today, I know the big ticket item was putting together a train set for one of your grandchildren. So good luck with that.
All right. Thank you.
And blessing on your work.
Thank you very much. It's been an honor.
Thank you for listening to Religion and American Life, a podcast by the Boisy Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. This podcast was hosted by Mark Massa of the Society of Jesus, director of the Boisy Center. The music you heard was composed and performed by Boston College's own Nova Wang. And a special thanks is owed to Jonathan Sage and Boston College's Media Technology Services for their outstanding assistance in the production of this podcast.